Apart from the still distant threat of international sanction, the United States has good reason to investigate and reform on its own. Over the past 40 years, there have been a half dozen major scandals over torture that produced dozens of congressional and executive investigations, usually yielding very modest reforms. In July 2011, we're releasing an unusually detailed, hard-hitting report on crimes of torture committed by Bush-era officials, Human Rights Watch recommended, quote, an independent, nonpartisan commission along the lines of the 9/11 Commission should be established to examine the actions of the executive branch, the CIA, the military, and Congress with regard to Bush administration policies and practices that led to detainee abuse. Unless such a formal inquiry is convened to investigate this history of coercive interrogation and begin to break the cycle of secrecy, expose, and impunity, we are likely in a few years to find ourselves once again facing another major torture scandal arising from some newly discovered dungeon in Asia, Africa, or the Middle East. When that happens, the world will not have forgotten those photos from Abu Ghraib. The damage to this country's international standing will likely be nothing short of devastating.
Before the dust had settled on the site of the 9/11 attack on the Twin Towers, controversy arose over the interrogation of detainees accused of being involved in it. What interrogation methods prompted the objections to the treatment of alleged Al-Qaeda operatives and others in U.S. hands? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What crucial and timely information did the CIA gain from their controversial interrogation methods? What constitutes torture, and at what point are enhanced interrogation techniques counterproductive for the government using them? Our guest is Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the UW-Madison and author of various books, including Policing America's Empire and, most recently, Torture and Impunity, published in 2012 by the University of Wisconsin Press.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you, Emily.
I noticed that the dedication of your new book, Torture and Impunity, is to the victims of torture. Could you talk a little bit about your reason for writing this newest book on torture?
Sure. In many ways, it's to fulfill that dedication. I wrote this dedication to Maria Elena Ang and the other victims of torture whose testimony will one day, I believe, end this cruel practice. And when I started out on this process a quarter century ago of investigating torture and its impact upon the perpetrators, this work was given real impetus because I was sitting in my office. I was then an academic in Sydney, Australia, and there was a knock on my door, and it wasn't office hours. I was irritated, and I went to the door, and there was this tall Filipina looking straight at me and said, "Hi, I'm Maria Elena Ang. I was tortured, and I want to talk to you." And she described her experience of having been tortured brutally, savagely, sexually by a man who was then regarded as something of a military hero in the Philippines because he had been the key strategist, a colonel who had been a key strategist that planned the uprising that overthrew the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos. And what I discovered was that these mid-ranking Filipino military officers who had sparked the events that culminated in the overthrow of Ferdinand Marcos had spent the previous decade not as intelligence officers or field officers, but as special security officers running safe houses, doing torture. And what I discovered was that torture, particularly the psychological doctrine that the United States had introduced into the Philippines, and a doctrine that was practiced by the Philippine military, had a curious and paradoxical effect. While through medical research we now know that torture incapacitates, sometimes even destroys the victim, what I found through interviews with victims like Maria Elena Ang, and then through their perpetrators, their torturers, that the perpetrators were empowered by the experience, that torture had a contradictory effect, destroyed the victims and empowered the perpetrators. So that these colonels emerged from the safe houses, the torture chambers of the Marcos regime, emboldened no longer uniformed servants of the state, but determined to become almost like Nietzschean supermen, its master. And they, This coterie of colonels launched a half dozen coups in an attempt to overthrow the Philippine state. The last of their major coups was blocked by President George H.W. Bush when he scrambled phantom jets over Manila in December of 1989 and basically threatened to bomb the coup plotters unless they turned back from the palace. They got that close to capturing the palace. They then retreated into the underground, and then they emerged from that underground in the early 1990s, and they became media superstars, unrepentant, unapologetic, feeling no shame, no guilt. Two of them ran for office. There are 24 senators in the Philippines. Two of the 24 senators for a time were former torturers, members of this coterie. And what I discovered was that this same sense of empowerment also made the torturers very determined to win impunity for their actions. And I then, as you know, from this experience watching this process in the Philippines, the perpetrators empowered by the torturers, the complexities that this imposed upon the society, and the determination by which these former torturers won and gained political impunity, indeed vindication, I then watched, starting in 2001, this same process playing out in the United States. Under the Bush administration, we had some very empowered politicians, Dick Cheney, people in the Justice Department, President Bush himself, who defaulted to torture in the aftermath of 9/11 attacks. They advocated that torture. They used media to normalize it in this society. And then once they lost power in 2008, they campaigned aggressively through the media to win impunity for their crimes, and they've indeed won it.
Your focus then is going to be primarily on torture as practiced by the United States and its client states?
That's correct. That's correct.
And how far back do we need to look to understand the American approach to torture?
We have to look all the way back to the origins of the Cold War. At the start of the Cold War in the late 1940s, the Soviet Union and its satellite states in Eastern Europe ran a series of show trials. For example, in Hungary, a cardinal, a prince, a primate of the church, was put on trial, and he testified in an almost confessed in his testimony in a kind of automaton-like way that looked like he'd been broken through torture. And in Romania, Protestant pastors again testified in the same way. And so we thought that maybe from Pavlov and his experiments that somehow the Soviets had cracked the code of human consciousness. So initially, defensively, the U.S. intelligence community began looking into torture. They experimented with all kinds of exotic techniques, electroshock, hypnosis, drugs, mescaline, LSD, marijuana, you name it. And gradually, they came to the idea that they could use this offensively, that they could develop interrogation techniques that would allow them to just break down double agents or infiltrators, high-value Soviet captives. And from about 1950 to 1962, the CIA led a kind of a Manhattan Project of the mind, trying to discover methods for unlocking human consciousness and people to give information that they were not inclined to give, a doctrine of coercive interrogation. And what they very quickly found was all the exotic techniques didn't work. LSD didn't work, the mescaline, the marijuana, electroshocks, hypnosis, none of that worked. And all that work was done in-house. But they then outsourced rather mundane behavioral research to top academics, particularly psychologists in Canada and the United States. And by trial and error, these psychologists came up with two techniques that worked. One, an absolutely brilliant Canadian psychologist named Donald Hebb, working under a contract for the Defense Research Board of Canada, which was collaborating with the CIA in this project, he discovered sensory deprivation. He hired medical students at McGill, and he put them in air-conditioned cubicles with goggles, gloves, and earmuffs, and found that, first of all, they would begin hallucinating far more extremely than they would on powerful drugs, just by the deprivation of sensory stimulus. And then he found that a number of them would actually suffer almost psychotic episodes. They'd have breakdowns. And the CIA then adopted this technique, finding that it made the victim much more likely to bond with the interrogator, that the stimulus that the interrogator offered would relieve the pain of the deprivation and form a bond and make this a very effective technique. The other techniques were really self-inflicted pain, were discovered by two researchers at Cornell University Medical Center in New York. that reviewed the agency's files on Soviet interrogation techniques, and found that the most effective Soviet technique was simply making a victim stand immobile for days at a time. And the fluids would flow to the legs. Sometimes the separating lesions would evolve. There'd be breakdowns, incredibly painful. And this was self-inflicted pain. And so these two basic techniques, sensory deprivation and self-inflicted pain, were incorporated into something called the QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual. QBARC is a CIA cryptonym for itself. In other words, it's the CIA secret word for the CIA. So it's really the CIA Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual in 1963. And they made these two techniques the basis of U.S. psychological interrogation, psychological torture.
Is this legal? Was it legal then?
It was legal then, yes, technically, because, it depends on legality. At that point, before 1994, we had not ratified the UN Convention Against Torture, and we had not introduced legislation. So legality is, that's a key question. So these techniques were technically legal. But the other thing to remember about the Cold War is that although the CIA developed these techniques and they propagated them through training to U.S. allies or around the world, sometimes very aggressively, as in South Vietnam, we didn't actually do this ourselves, okay? We were dealing with sovereign states who had their own security forces and who maintained the prison. So we trained the interrogators abroad, whether in Uruguay or Honduras or South Vietnam or the Philippines, and they trained the interrogators, they ran the prisons, and then we harvested the intelligence.
But we weren't actually doing it.
Over the course of time, as this set of techniques were used, sensory deprivation and then this self-inflicted pain, as you call it, somewhere along the line there has to be an evaluation. I mean, moral issues aside, there has to be an evaluation of the quality of the information derived from those forms of interrogation. Was there no quality control in that sense?
No. The metrics on it were never clearly established because the process is too complex. So in the about 2004, the CIA Inspector General reviewed the past 3 years of really harsh techniques inside the CIA black sites in which they used these techniques plus some more coercive physical techniques called wall slamming. I mean, they did things like threaten to have mothers and daughters raped inside prisons in their native lands for Arab detainees, put drills up to the head and ran drills, cocked guns in the head. I mean, and these, by the way, are death threats, and they are illegal under U.S. law. Okay, since the ratification of the UN Convention Against Torture, they did all these things. The CIA Inspector General said it cannot be established in any way that these techniques were productive. They didn't necessarily work because the process of extracting information is so complex. In fact, we've had a debate about this. Most people don't recognize that we've had a debate about this. It began with the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks in August and September of 2011, and it's run right up to the present. And the debate has been done through what I call dueling memoirs. In August of last year, August 2011, Vice President Cheney published his memoirs in which he claimed that the CIA enhanced interrogation techniques were brilliantly effective. And he cited, by the way, the case that all neoconservatives cite. President Bush cites it, CIA cites it, Cheney cites it, everybody cites it. The first interrogation using these techniques, a man named Abu Zubaydah, who was captured in a raid in Pakistan, was shot and wounded, was rendered to Thailand, a CIA safe house, and there he was interrogated. And according to Cheney, these enhanced techniques transformed almost magically this hardened terrorist into a fount of information, just gushed information and gave us all our major breaks in al-Qaeda. And Cheney put this out in the public. He argued for it determinedly, and indeed, for the previous few years, he and his daughter Liz have been on the airwaves, Fox News, CNN, arguing for this point of view that these techniques worked. They produce national security. Therefore, any attempt to prosecute or punish the CIA operatives or Bush administration lawyers that advocated these techniques was completely misguided.
The end justifies the means.
No, this worked. Okay. 2 weeks later, Okay, 2 weeks later, a former top FBI counterterrorism agent, a Lebanese-American named Ali Soufan, published his memoirs. And he has several chapters in his book describing the same interrogation. And this is really fascinating because this is as close to a scientific experiment as you could conduct into the relative effectiveness of these two techniques. And what Ali Soufan describes, and it's very hard to figure it out because the CIA imposed 181 pages of censorship on Ali Soufan's memoirs, blacking out all these passages, critiquing his methods. But he had testified previously before the U.S. Senate. So if you combine the Senate testimony with the fragments of the memoir, and I mean it's like a maze of black lines, and you weave them together, you can figure out what he's saying, and you can reconstruct this experiment. It's an experiment of four parts. Part one, Abu Zubaydah is captured. Ali Soufan is sent out from Washington, D.C., flies to Bangkok, he goes to the safe house. He walks in, and he's a fluent Arabic speaker. He says to Abu Zubaydah, "Mind if I call you Hani?" Hani was his mother's nickname for him, so he's got him right away. He starts talking to him, builds up rapport, and Ali Soufan gives up the name, which we didn't know, of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as being the key al-Qaeda planner. This is a big breakthrough, okay? So George Tenet hears about this. He's first of all happy. Then he hears it's the FBI, not the CIA,
different
that scored
techniques.
This coup, mm-hmm. right? George Tenet, being CIA director, gets angry, pounds the table, and takes the psychologist, the contract psychologist, Dr. James Mitchell, who's developed all these enhanced techniques for the CIA, puts him on an airplane with some CIA guys, flies him out to Bangkok. Mitchell comes in, takes over, and starts ramping up on the level of coercive techniques. Okay, Abu Zubaydah shuts down. Won't give a thing. So second time, they bring in Ali Soufan. He reestablishes rapport. Okay, this time, they get the name of Jose Padilla, the guy who is supposed to have planned the bombing of apartment buildings in Chicago and murder and mayhem across America. We didn't know this name either. So we get that one as well. Okay, well, the CIA comes back in. They start ramping up on these techniques. So for, and Abu Zubaydah shuts down. A third time, Ali Soufan's brought in. This time, it's harder to get him to open up because he's been badly abused. But finally, he reestablishes rapport, and he gives more details about Jose Padilla. Okay, the fourth time, the CIA is going to start confining Abu Zubaydah in a confinement box, okay, and use techniques of extreme deprivation, which Ali Soufan feels are torture. He communicated with his headquarters in Washington. FBI said, "Get out of there. We don't do this kind of stuff. You know, get on a plane. Go." So, okay, what this means is that in a comparative test of these techniques, time and again, okay, in an almost scientific experiment established clearly, FBI empathetic techniques, asking questions in a person's language, establishing a rapport through a skilled interrogator, well-trained, well-informed, extracts very valuable intelligence. Using these harsh techniques failed. And that's as close to a test as we can go. You know, what's really interesting is that Dick Cheney, in his memoirs, makes no mention of the FBI, you know, attributes everything to the CIA using these harsh techniques. And then in April this year, a man named Jose Rodriguez, who was head of the counterterrorism center at the CIA and thus presided generally over this interrogation, published his memoirs titled Hard Measures, in which he calls, in an interview on 60 Minutes, any claim that the FBI techniques, he used a more vulgar term, BS. He didn't actually use the initials. And he claims that the CIA-enhanced techniques extracted all the useful information. So there we have. You know, we've had this sort of final step in the process of impunity and this attempt by Cheney and Bush and Jose Rodriguez to rewrite history. And yet when we actually read the memoir of the chief interrogator who was there present, we discover that they are misrepresenting the facts fundamentally.
And how, then, would we define torture? Is there a legal definition?
Well, that's been a major focus of this political debate in the United States. The definition is central to the prohibition and the prosecution. I suppose the turning point in the definitional aspects of torture came in 1994, when the United States finally ratified the UN Convention Against Torture. It was approved by the UN General Assembly unanimously in the 1980s. The Reagan administration sent it to Congress. Congress chose not to ratify it. The Reagan administration, when it sent it to Congress, introduced what are called diplomatic reservations. In other words, we ratify the treaty, but We have this exception or this qualification. Well, when the Clinton administration sent the UN Convention Against Torture to the U.S. Congress for ratification in 1994, they simply dusted off the Reagan-era reservations verbatim and sent them to Congress. And so the treaty was ratified. And all of these reservations, four paragraphs of reservation, are focused on one word in the 26 printed pages of the UN Convention. That word is mental. And the U.S. redefined, okay, the mental torture or psychological torture, because that's the doctrine we developed during the Cold War with all that CIA research and all those funds. Okay, we redefined it. The UN simply banned the infliction of severe physical and psychological pain. Okay, that very broad. Okay, we in our reservation, a reservation which got incorporated into our ratification of the UN Convention Against Torture, and then got also incorporated verbatim into four major subsequent federal laws enacted between 1996 and 2006 that translate the UN Convention into actual U.S. law. Okay, we redefined it. Instead of prohibiting severe physical or mental pain, we redefined mental pain as prolonged mental harm. Now, I just said prolonged mental harm, and you look at me, okay? First of all, how long is prolonged?
When you're being tortured, a few seconds is a long time.
But prolonged mental harm, does that mean it lasts a year, a decade, a lifetime? Okay, and harm. What's the standard of harm? What constitutes harm? Does one have to have simply nightmares, feel upset, or do you have to be virtually catatonic, that's to say incapacitated? Okay? So through the introduction of this subtle change of language, basically what the United States is redefined torture. And then there came another part, okay? What constitutes the prolonged mental harm? Okay? In order under our reservation, okay, there are only four techniques that we recognize as inflicting prolonged mental harm. Okay? These techniques are first of all, forced ingestion of drugs, extreme physical pain, threats to death threats to the victim, and death threats to a third party, a next of kin or a comrade. Okay, anything else does not constitute torture. So, for example, in these CIA black sites, as they were run in 2002 and 2003, one of the tactics used by U.S. agents was to threaten to have the detainee's wife or mother arrested by allied intelligence agents in the Middle East and have them raped.
And that's counter to one of those four that you just
mentioned.
No, it's
not.
It's not.
Perfectly
no.
legal. Because we're not threatened to, okay, we haven't threatened the victim with
right.
extreme mental harm. We haven't ingested him with drugs. We haven't threatened to kill him, or we haven't threatened to kill
the third party.
Okay,
so mm-hmm. brutal sexual assault, perfectly fine. And then, it's an almost absurd narrowing, but that's the way we've narrowed it.
So you could, in fact, take that third party and subject them to the same, whatever you want to call it, enhanced interrogation technique that you're applying to the subject in the first place. You could go that far with that third party as long as you're not killing them.
Exactly.
And still conform to the UN resolution.
And we all know this because if you recall that very controversial August 2002 torture memo written by now federal judge Jay Bybee, who was then head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, and his associate John Yoo. Okay, and they said that physical pain was acceptable right up to the level of organ failure. All right, in other words, what is organ failure? That means the heart stops beating, the kidney shuts down, the liver shuts down. I mean, that's extreme pain. Okay, and that's been repudiated by the Justice Department. But interestingly, in 2006. When the Bush administration decided that it would regularize its procedures, it brought in all of the al-Qaeda suspects who were held in CIA black sites, transferred them to Guantanamo, put them on trial planned to put them on trial before the military commissions. And then they sent legislation to Congress called the Military Commissions Act 2006, okay, which is a part of the process of impunity. In that legislation, they defined physical pain, physical torture, as tantamount to organ failure. In other words, they took the language out of this now repudiated Justice Department and they wrote in the legislation. And then they also, for mental torture, they repeated verbatim the reservations from our ratification of the UN Anti-Torture Convention, and they put that right into this legislation again, absolutely verbatim.
Now, what legal effect, what legal force do those reservations have? Does that mean the United States can sign off on this treaty without complying?
No, we comply fully. Basically, what we did is we agreed to comply fully with the UN prohibition on physical abuse as written by the UN, but we specified the nature of psychological abuse, psychological torture, through this language of prolonged mental harm and these four specific means by which that harm must be inflicted in order to narrow the possibilities, allowing the sensory deprivation and the self-inflicted pain and the techniques that spring from that that are core to the agency's doctrine and a doctrine that's in modified form used in some occasions by the U.S. military.
I think we've all seen the disturbing photos of hooded prisoners at Abu Ghraib, and we'll talk about what impact that had on our understanding of torture when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Alfred McCoy, and we're talking about enhanced interrogation techniques, torture. You can perhaps put your own label according to where you're coming from when you look at the way the United States interrogates suspects, prisoners, detainees. Those words all become words in play also. One of the most notorious instances in recent years of the United States policy toward its detainees is the whole Abu Ghraib phenomenon. What happened there that the United States had to disavow, and how did it affect the whole public perception of torture or these techniques, these enhanced interrogation techniques that the United States has been using?
What happened very simply was that one of the military police working in Abu Ghraib was deeply disturbed by the way the detainees were being treated, and he saw images on computers and he downloaded them to a CD and he delivered them to the Army Criminal Investigation Command, which is basically the Army's internal police maintaining good order and discipline and compliance with the laws of war within the ranks of the U.S. military. And this sparked an investigation. Simultaneously, about 17 or 18 of these images were leaked to CBS television in April 2004. CBS 60 Minutes broadcast those still images. And those are just a fraction of the 1,600 images that were actually on that compact disc recovered by the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command. And I suppose we could focus on the most iconic of all those images, which, as we all know, is that of an Iraqi detainee standing on a box, arms extended, bag on his head, and then fake electrical wires hanging from his arms. When we look at that image, it looks kind of benign, particularly compared to the others in the files, which involve nudity, stress position, shackling, long shackling, short shackling.
Dogs.
Mm-hmm. The dogs, simulated sexual acts, individual and group. I mean, they're the real images, the ones we don't see, and also without the genitalia blocked out, because they are stripped absolutely naked in much of this performative and degrading simulated sex. Okay, so this is a benign image, but when you look at it, when you look at that image, you can see, if you will, enfolded in that single image, this whole history of U.S. development of psychological interrogation techniques. First of all, he's hooded. What's the effect of that? That's sensory deprivation. Mm-hmm. He's denied
right.
sight.
I mean, right.
Okay. And his arms are extended, and the wires, we believe he was told that if he dropped his arms, he would be electrocuted. And so that's the self-inflicted pain. That's those two basic doctrines developed after that decade of very expensive research from 1950 to 1963 and codified in the CIA's QBAR counterintelligence interrogation manual and disseminated to allied nations and the U.S. intelligence community. And despite the shocking impact and demonstrations around the globe and public outrage and editorials, you know, within 4 months of the release of those photos, there was polling done in the United States that determined that 35% of the American people would state, and this is extraordinary, would state to a pollster that they felt that torture was still acceptable under some circumstances. And that raises a question is, you know, why and how did that revelation and all the politics and debate that sprang from it, because we're now just emerging from a decade of an epical, intense debate over torture in this country, why didn't it arouse deeper public outrage, public demands for reform, which would have forced the administration, Bush and Obama, to take a very different response? And looking back on that decade, I conclude that the intense saturation of this society, in this society of images, seductive, enticing, appealing images of torture on media screens, large and small, served to normalize torture for most Americans, transforming it from an abomination into a policy option. I mean, when you think about it, first of all, I mentioned earlier, you know, this proliferation of media images on television, epitomized, of course, by the show 24. But a surprisingly large number of big-budget Hollywood films also had torture. Let's take among the 21 James Bond films, the most popular ever is the recent Casino Royale, which grossed $600 million worldwide, and it's the number one among the 21 Bond films. The central defining episode in that film is a brutal torture scene with James Bond, played by Daniel Craig, his body shaved of male body hair in the conventions of homoerotic pornography, okay, in which he's beaten about the genitalia by the evil Le Chiffre, okay, and you know, and unlike James Bond in every other circumstance, is dominated, broken by this experience, and only released by a plot device, which in which another villain arrives and kills Le Chiffre, and Daniel Craig gets away. But he's broken by this savage sexual torture. And, you know, the Mel Gibson, Passion of the Christ, he took, you know, what is it, 11 words in the gospel, you know, Pontius Pilate ordered Jesus scourged, or words to that effect. Okay, there's 11 words in the gospel. Mel Gibson turned that into 8 minutes out of 120 minutes in his movie, 8 long minutes of a brutal, savage torture scene of Roman soldiers beating Christ and transforming his body on screen into a suppurating mass of interlaced lesions, leaving him lying on the ground, oozing blood. I mean, you know, and it was, in lest we forget, video games, good heavens. The World of Warcraft came out, its first one, its release in 2008, had a neural needler involving, it's built into the device where you have to torture and extract information to advance in the game. That game sold 2,800,000 on day one, okay? So, you know, it's widescreen cinema, it's television, it's video games.
Why? If you step back and try to analyze why this obsession with violence and why it seems to have escalated, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what happened is that we don't understand the process very well, but media is very sensitive to government policy in a modern state, and media takes all kinds of signals. Sometimes they're direct. When, for example, the administration decides they want to crack down on drugs, they'll get media executives from Hollywood into Washington to have a conference, and all of a sudden we'll have anti-drug messages in our media. Well, now here's an administration, the Bush administration, signaled to the nation through President Bush's statement and statement by CIA representatives before Congress, that we're going to get tough, we're going to take the gloves off, in the words of CIA operative Kofor Black, okay? And the media picked up on this, and we had this sort of, as we recoiled from the 9/11 attacks, part of our way to recoil was to embrace the idea of torture as an effective means of defending the nation.
Now, getting back to Abu Ghraib, a lot of the fallout from that seemed to have been a matter of really how could you spin it to look as, if that's the word to use, as good as possible. In other words, I think one impression was that these were things that were unauthorized, that this was a situation that had gone wrong, that somebody was asleep at the switch in the command structure that allowed all these things to happen, that they weren't actually part of interrogation, but they were just part of kind of a pointless abuse of the detainees.
Yeah, that was the sort of first step in impunity, and it happens transnationally. One of the first things that happens is that whether it's, let's say, in the United Kingdom when they had torture in Northern Ireland or in France when they had torture in Algeria, is to blame it on the bad apples, that this is the aberrant action of a few rogue operatives. And right after the Abu Ghraib photographs were released by CBS 60 Minutes, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announced that this was done by a small number of U.S. military. And William Safire, the conservative columnist then writing for the New York Times, branded these people as creeps. And there were a dozen investigations done by the Pentagon that more or less reached various forms of that resolution. So all the prosecutions were done basically of military police and didn't really rise much above the level of soldiers and non-commissioned officers. It didn't get into the higher ranks. It certainly didn't get in up the chain of command from whence the policy came. And actually, interestingly, in I think May 2009, when President Obama announced his – defended his decision not to release any more of the Abu Ghraib photographs, those 1,600, which are truly horrific – he said that this was done by a small number of U.S. military. In other words, he paraphrased almost word for word what Rumsfeld had said back in 2004. That was the first step in impunity. The next step in impunity is usually it's necessary for national security. And Vice President Cheney has made that argument along with his daughter Liz time and time again. They go on Fox Media, they go on CNN. At various points when this was being debated in 2009, 2010, they would literally make dozens of media appearances making that argument. The Obama administration didn't challenge this point, and so it sort of stood uncontested in the public domain. The next step in impunity transnationally in societies, the surprisingly large number of societies emerging from torture, is to say that we need to bury this and kind of move forward together. This is all part of the past, unfortunate perhaps, but we need to go forward together. And in April of 2009, when President Obama visited the CIA to kind of establish his relationship with the agency and spoke to the employees there, he made a public statement saying that this was done in the past and we needed to move forward together. In other words, basically telling the CIA that he would not advocate any accounting for these crimes. The next stage in impunity is a much more controversial one and much less common, in which the perpetrators and the powerful that authorize them seek not simply exoneration, you know, i.e. non-punishment. They seek vindication, that they were the ones that had the courage to do what needed to be done in the nation's hour of crisis, and so that there has been an intense debate. Okay, we saw it last year, actually very clearly, very dramatically, when the Obama administration killed Osama bin Laden, and everybody from former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, Rumsfeld himself, Liz Cheney, former Vice President Dick Cheney, they all went in the media and claimed that, you know, clearly the enhanced CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques had produced the intelligence that had led us to Osama bin Laden. And Senator McCain, the former Republican presidential candidate, went over to the CIA, got a full briefing, and wrote an op-ed. Then the Washington Post said, not true. There's no basis for making that claim. Spokesman for the U.S. National Security Council also stated there is no basis for making that claim. You know, intelligence gathered, such as it might be, from enhanced interrogation in 2004 and 2005 had very little to do to tracking down Osama bin Laden in 2011. It had nothing
to do. It's interesting that you should mention John McCain, who, of course, was himself the victim during his Vietnam War days of, I guess you would call it, enhanced interrogation.
No, he was beaten crudely, brutally, by North Vietnamese physical techniques.
And as a fairly conservative Republican, nonetheless, where does he stand then? I gather he's saying that these techniques are not productive.
Actually, McCain has taken a very clear and consistent position on this. You know, throughout this entire debate, he has come forward and drawn upon his status as a POW who was subjected to brutal torture to simply say that it does not work. He's not bought into any of the myths surrounding torture, the ticking time bomb, the Jack Bauer mystique, the whole ethos of enhanced interrogation. He fought the Bush administration from inside the Republican Party. He actually got legislation enacted in Congress in late 2005 that sought to restrict the use of these techniques on detainees. Amendments that were inserted in that legislation blunted much of the impact.
And he's spoken out against waterboarding.
Yes,
we haven't mentioned that, but waterboarding has also gotten a lot of attention as a technique that America has been using very controversially.
Yeah, and McCain also, in the presidential debates in 2008, he was very critical of the Republican candidates who in the Republican primaries were sort of outdoing each other to scramble to embrace torture. One of the early Republican debates was branded by the Los Angeles Times as a Jack Bauer look-alike contest, in which Giuliani, Tancredo, all the rest were jumping over each other to make claims. Mitt Romney saying, I want to double Guantanamo. I want to do everything possible, insisting that these techniques be used. McCain stood apart from that, absolutely.
We're going to talk about Guantanamo and other questions of recent use of torture when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Alfred McCoy, whose new book is called Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation. You mentioned Guantanamo Bay, another political hot potato. Can you talk about what happens there and why it's still an issue now?
Sure. Guantanamo became, during the Bush administration, synonymous beyond the United States as a kind of Latter-day Devil's Island, a phrase, a place that became identified with extraordinarily harsh techniques and almost limitless incarceration under extreme conditions by detainees, prompting the British government, for example, to demand that all of its detainees, all of its citizens who were detained there, to be removed, because they. The various British law lords, the British Attorney General, called Guantanamo and the military commissions an absolute mockery of justice. So Guantanamo became, under the Bush administration, really an iconic symbol of the least palatable aspects of the Bush administration's policy of interrogation and incarceration. And one of the things that President Obama promised to do when he took office was that he promised to close Guantanamo within a year. And the U.S. Congress enacted legislation that barred any funding for anything that would close Guantanamo, insisting that Guantanamo remained open. And then Obama tried to actually take the detainees and put them through the civil courts and conduct a trial of some of the detainees in New York City. This produced massive objections from various New York politicians. So the Obama administration has gotten sort of stuck with Guantanamo and the military commissions. And they've tried to clean up the military commissions, develop procedures that will remove all the most objectionable features that the international legal community found unacceptable and the U.S. Supreme Court initially found unacceptable. And they're now moving forward with these with the trials of some of the accused in the military commissions, claiming that it's cleaned up. And the international human rights community and the U.S. human rights community remains at this point unconvinced. So this is a one of these areas that's unresolved. It's if you will, exemplary of the way that this whole debate that we've had over the past 10 years has boiled down to a series of compromises that work within our polarized, even paralyzed bipartisan politics, which don't work internationally, okay? I mean, what we've come to through this entire process is impunity at home and rendition abroad. And part of that impunity is, in fact, keeping Guantanamo in place, keeping the military commissions going. And this is a political compromise that the rest of the world, I don't think, will find acceptable over the long term.
And what do you mean by rendition? You mean going forward and continuing to torture?
Well, as I explained obliquely, I guess, in the beginning, that during the Cold War, the United States, although we developed sophisticated techniques for psychological interrogation, and we gave them to our allies, we didn't actually do it ourselves.
The outsourcing.
We outsourced it to our allies.
But that's what's meant by rendition, is someone does it for us?
Yeah, but rendition is the act. Extraordinary rendition is the act of transporting someone from one jurisdiction to another, okay? And right at the start of the Obama administration, when he was writing those dramatic presidential orders, closing the CIA black sites and barring the use of those techniques, when he drafted that, he actually ordered the closure of all CIA incarceration facilities around the world. Okay, it was much broader language, and the CIA came to him and said, "If you write that order that way, you put us out of the rendition business." And so he modified it, and he put in a footnote, which said that the CIA could maintain a facility used for short-term transport of prisoners. Okay, so that even in seemingly to prohibiting, you know, the abuse which was synonymous with the Bush administration, which Obama himself had attacked directly and forcefully in the 2008 presidential campaign, even in the presidential orders, okay, fulfilling his promises not to engage in rendition, he stuck in loopholes that allowed the CIA to engage in rendition. And indeed, that has been our strategy. We've closed down the CIA black sites. The CIA is no longer interrogating. It's no longer dirtying its hands with waterboarding or wall slamming. Instead, we're outsourcing this to our allies around the world. Let's say in Iraq, right after Abu Ghraib, the U.S. military command began transferring incarceration of sensitive detainees to Iraqi authorities. And as almost a matter of policy, the U.S. military received 1,300 reports of abuse of detainees by Iraqi forces from 2004 to 2009 and took no action whatsoever. So, in effect, we transferred the abuse to our Iraqi allies. Same thing in Afghanistan, okay? Most of the prisons are run by Afghan authorities. Afghan intelligence is brutal. The UN have investigated them, looked into hundreds of cases. They're absolutely brutal. Some of our allies will not transfer their detainees to the Afghan authorities. We have no reservation. We turn them over. We make no criticism. So, in effect, we outsource the abuse of detainees to our Iraqi and Afghan allies. And we've continued to engage in rendition. Right now, one of the major battlefronts in the war on terror is East Africa. And the Somali National Intelligence operates a prison called The Hole. Okay, it's the basement of the former headquarters of Somali National Intelligence. And we snatch suspects out of the slums of Nairobi, put them on an airplane flying to Mogadishu, put them in that facility, which we pay for. We think we pay for it anyway. It's a part of the CIA intelligence budget. And then CIA operatives can go in there and harvest the intelligence. So we're engaging in rendition even now. Even though that is under the terms of the U.S. ratification of the Convention Against Torture, that's prohibited under Article 3.
So the U.N. seems to have no muscle then?
No. I mean, the mechanism for the enforcement of these international prohibitions on torture is twofold. U.S. legislation, the legislation we enact to make it a part of U.S. law, and it's indeed part of U.S. law, but it's qualified and compromised by all the loopholes that I've described. And the other mechanism for enforcing this is twofold. One is the International Criminal Court, but that has limited authority because the three major powers in the world, Russia, China, and the United States, haven't ratified the convention. Okay, so, you know, we're exempt from it. The other mechanism beyond the bounds of U.S. law is the universal jurisdiction by other nations that have ratified the U.N. Convention Against Torture. Belgium, Germany, Spain claim that human rights abuse, and this is common international law, is a crime against humanity. And therefore, the jurisdiction is international. So no matter where the crime occurred, if the a sovereign court, you know, has the right to has a responsibility, if the state in which the crime occurred doesn't prosecute, then it's possible for a Belgian, German, Spanish court under the doctrine of U.S. universal jurisdiction to engage in a prosecution. And last year, President Bush had to cancel a trip to Switzerland because the Center for Constitutional Rights in the United States worked with Swiss lawyers to actually draw on Bush's own memoirs and charge him with human rights abuse before Swiss courts. They were moving, and so President Bush had to cancel a trip to Switzerland because potentially he could have been indicted. There have been moves by human rights groups to indict various U.S. officials in Germany, which the U.S. has worked diplomatically to block. But slowly, gradually, this U.S. diplomatic pressure blocking this universal jurisdiction began to break down. For example, 22 CIA operatives and a U.S. Air Force colonel were prosecuted by a Milan court and found guilty for snatching an Egyptian supposed terrorist off the streets of Milan, flying into Egypt where he was brutally tortured by Egyptian security services. The Milan court convicted 22 CIA operatives. If they turn up in Italy, they'll be arrested. That's extraordinary. I mean, Italian intelligence and U.S. intelligence from the darkest days of the Cold War worked hand in glove together. We're very close allies. To have an Italian court prosecute U.S. Intelligence operatives is extraordinary. Moreover, there have been official investigations in Lithuania and Poland, and the head of the Poland Security Service is now on trial under indictment. His crime? Working with the CIA to set up a black site in violation of Poland's ratification of the European Human Rights Convention and the UN Convention Against Torture. So that although the process of impunity is complete within the United States, nonetheless, there is this avenue, the international community and its claim to universal jurisdiction over human rights abuse. That represents a real problem for the United States going forward into the future.
Our guest has been Alfred McCoy, whose book, Torture and Impunity, is trying to shed light on a decade of cover-up. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.